This is AutoLine After Hours with Gary Vasilash and John McElroy, episode 410 for February 23rd, 2018. Nissan sprouts a new leaf. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLine.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific Time. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine in iTunes, Stitcher, or on YouTube.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems. And by Hyundai, better drives us.
All right, another AutoLine After Hours. Mr. Vasilash, good to see you here.
Yeah, it's been hours.
It's been hours. Gary and I spent the last couple of days driving around Austin, Texas in the new Volvo XC40. We can probably talk about that later in the show. But we got to let everybody know we've got Daron Levine here. He is the host of In the Driver's Seat on Sirius XM, channel 121. When's your show on?
On noon, at noon on Saturday.
Okay, so everybody with Sirius, and
when
you're in your car
people.
Saturday, remember channel 121.
Yeah, give Howard Stern a break and turn my show on.
You get Howard money?
Do I give you money?
Yeah.
Everybody else is giving him money. I don't have any money left because we're all giving it to Howard.
Okay, but let's get to the real reason why we're doing this show here, and that's because we've got Chris Reed, the Vice President of Engineering for Nissan, and we've got the Nissan Leaf in the studio. But first of all, welcome back. It's great to have you here on the show.
It's great to be here. It's really fun. I was just thinking, it's been like 2-3 years, right?
That's right. You were here for the Murano last time, right?
Murano, exactly.
So you work on all kinds of vehicles at Nissan.
Yeah, we got the upper D platform, you think, and then EV. It does seem like an interesting combination, but, you know, it was a challenge, and I was ready for it. So it's a lot of fun.
Okay, I'm dying to learn about this car, so let's jump right into it. You know, every car company, when they go to do a redo of a car or even come out with a new one, sort of prepares a brief. What are three major things that we really got to nail on this car? What were the three major ones on this Leaf?
Well, you know, I think it's all about being mainstream, right? I think we chatted beforehand in the beginning here, which is like, you know, the original Leaf was cool. It was neat. It was kind of
quirky.
Well,
you can say that. It was.
Well.
I'll use Daron's
word. It was a little geeky. It was a little geeky, but it was cool.
There's eye of the beholder.
Yeah, that's right.
So, but, you know, we were looking for the innovators or the early adopters, and we wanted to set it apart from the others. And at the same time, a lot of people looked at it kind of like, eh, not for me. And that was the intention of that car, and it had some fun with it, you know.
We got a picture of it up right now.
We'll say cool headlamps, but other people would say bug eyes, you know, whatever it would be.
Right.
But obviously different from the whole portfolio. Now, I mean, we were talking about being here 3 years ago, talking about Murano. At that time, we established some of these styling themes from the beginning, right? The V-motion grille, the boomerang headlamps, that kind of stuff, floating roof. That was the Murano. Now it's on a Leaf. So we're kind of going mainstream, and we know that this is a step-by-step approach, right? So this is about getting the customer, everyone, more comfortable and used to seeing EVs, used to talking about EVs, used to seeing one charging on the corner. So you're kind of, you know, range anxiety is going down, and as we talked, I mean, it's about, but the value proposition is kind of going step-by-step at the same time. But.
Isn't that a danger, though, going mainstream, that if someone, I mean, someone who buys this vehicle, I mean, don't they want their neighbor to know that they have an electric car?
Well, you'd think so. I think, honestly, that's the 3% of the population that loves that, right? And so if you want to take it to the next level, you're going to have to get to the people that say, you know what, I just want to get in my car and go, and I want to have confidence that's going to get where I'm going. But you're right. And at the same time, we didn't forget about the EV loyalists, right? And, you know, we've got the signatures, you know, some of the blue accents on the car and some of the name plating, so that you still know it's an EV. But at the same time, we're trying to bring into the fold a little bit of the people who were, you know, didn't want to be an early adopter, don't want to show off the EV-ness.
Mm-hmm. I have an idea for you. You remember a long, long time ago, they had a tiger in your tank. You'd have like a tail hooked somewhere on this thing. You should have like a little extension cord with an electric plug that you could just place somewhere there. So if you see that thing, you know, ha, electric car.
Electric.
That's right. Have it jump out a little bit. But, you know, I mean, I think that's one thing you brought up, though, is about this whole kind of concept of tiger and power. I mean, that's the thing where I was talking to a friend of mine who was actually driving a hybrid and an Infiniti, and I asked him why he bought it. And he said, I want it because of the extra power. was like, wow, you know, that's unusual, right? We were talking before about people who are trying to justify, you know, the break-even point at, you know, 8 years out for an HEV or something like that. And that's not mainstream, right? People want it to pay off immediately. But this guy wanted it because of power. And that's, I think, one of the things we looked at for the new one here. So, you know, we took it as a, I think it was a practical way to get into the EV market originally with a, you know, 80-kilowatt motor and the range that was under 100 miles at the time. And thinking that people, even if we knew that people, you know, you track out the usage of people's 90% of their use is going to be under, you know, 100 miles, so it should hit everyone's usage. And practical state is that that's not kind of reality of people's mindset. But the power and the feeling, I think, has really started to explode here in the market, you know, with the high end of Teslas and that kind of stuff coming out and people saying, you know, like, I want a car that has performance. And I think, you know, we looked at it that way, too, for this new Leaf, to say, can we make it so it's a little more mainstream, it still has EV, has more range, has more power?
Well, we've all driven it, and
No, we haven't. I haven't driven it.
Oh, you haven't driven it yet? Yeah. Okay, so I was at the intro, and I drove it, and I can ratify that the torque is really nice. I mean, it's very, very quick out there, and it gives you a lot of the feel. Now, I haven't been in a Tesla, but people talk about Teslas being very fast. What they mean is it accelerates
it's
nicely.
Right?
It's got instantaneous acceleration, and this one has it. It really does it. It operates nicely in traffic, and it's good off the start. And if you're, you know, you see an opening in traffic somewhere, and you want to scoot in there, it helps.
Right.
You.
No lag. You get it. Yeah. This one is it's about 200 kilograms heavier. So it's
more battery.
Yeah. Well, you know exactly. We started kind of from the beginning. I think I kind of visualized it like a nice old home on Lake Michigan. And there's an ordinance there, right? You tear down the house, you leave the door, and you build around that. Well, we kind of looked at it the same way. Like, what works for this car? Well, we didn't want the battery to have a sacrifice to the customer, right? So we wanted a bigger battery, but we didn't want to take away the room. So I think it's about 40% more efficient from the energy density standpoint. We kept the same package, but it's definitely denser, and we changed the pack of the cells and wanted to get, you know, we got, it went from, well, the motor went from 80 to 110 kilowatt, and went to a 40 kilowatt battery, so 30 to 40 kilowatts. So the point of that was to give this range. You know, they went from 107 mile range to this 150 mile range, not taking anything away from the customer from the packaging. At the same time, overcome the mass, right? Mass. So that's where the extra torque comes in, and so you actually have a torquier car with more range, more power, actually slightly more packaging size inside, more mainstream. Kind of get it all. Price, actually, we lowered the price of the thing, too. So
I think it's really an ideal car for, my wife is a teacher. She drives a Honda Civic. She's never more than 20 miles away from our house. I think if you have that kind of a usage pattern, and you have a garage, and you don't like to get outside of your car in cold weather and fill it with gasoline, this is a perfect car for you.
You're right. You're exactly right, because you don't leave your house every day with a full tank of gas, right? Everyone has their own comfort zone when they want to fill it up, but this is plug it in every night, leave with a full tank. I got a funny story. It's like my wife, Mandy, she works in Birmingham area. We live in Northville. And, you know, I think it's maybe like, it's like 12, 15 miles, something like that. And we had an original Leaf, the previous one, and I thought it was perfect from that same sense. You know, look, you're only going to have to go 14 miles a day. You've got a, you know, 107-mile range. This is going to be perfect. But in reality, struggled a little bit with her because that range anxiety really hit because she was like, a lot of what ifs, right? Well, what if I have to run up to Michigan State for my daughter Tess? What if I have to go here? What if I go there? So I was like, honey, how long is that? How many what ifs have we had in the last couple of years?
You know, zero.
Zero. And, you know, so it's overcoming that kind of fear or mindset.
Is this in your mind a daily driver for someone as their only car, or is it a second car? I mean, because arguably when you had the first generation car, because of that range, people would consider it to be a second car.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have an intention, we have reality. And I think reality is it's a perfect second car, right? Because really, I mean, my parents live in Pennsylvania and it's a 6.5-hour drive, and, you know, I forgot how many miles it is. And it's funny because you don't even think about the miles when you're in a regular car, because I know I can get 400 miles out of a gas tank. And the thought of, like, sitting and waiting for a recharge, at first I would think I don't want to do that. Reality is you're going to stop three times. We've got dogs. You've got to get gas anyways. You've got to get, you know, hamburgers, whatever you're going to get. Probably would be able to navigate that. But I think from everyone's mindset, it's we're kind of taking it step by step. So practically speaking, I think it's an amazing second car. Mm-hmm. I think it could be a first car for someone that had the right mindset. But real, if you want to have zero interruptions to your activities and things, I think. And in reality, think about, I mean, let's just say it's the same size as a Sentra, roughly speaking. And, you know, if you're a family and you've got dogs and kids and going to soccer practice, are you going to only have a Sentra? You know, probably not, right? You're going to have the sport utility for jumping around town and taking, going to hockey practice, and you're going to have the Sentra for getting the mileage because you're driving back and forth to the state, you know, for, an hour and a half each day. So I think it kind of fits in that same mindset.
Mm-hmm. And you have a bigger battery coming. I mean, that's sort of on, I know you're not supposed to talk about that, or we're not supposed to talk about that, but, but basically they have talked about it to
us. No, we have.
It's been announced.
Yeah.
I tell you, we listened a lot to the customers, and of course you'd like to say, let's give the biggest. I mean, bigger is always bigger and better, right? We know that. But the reality is, I think we looked at this was, you know, when you go to get a car, and you go to get a car for yourself, for your wife, for your daughter, I mean, the money comes into it, right? In the end of the day, you're like, well, you know, $10 extra, $50 extra a month, whatever it is, those decisions come down to that. So we really wanted to find the right balance. So I'm getting your answer in the long run here. But we said, you know, what's the right number? And we said, you know, we interviewed our customers, and they said, you know, usage is one thing, but about mindset and what you're looking for. And they said, you know, I want to pay less money. You know, it's like, and I want more range, and I want more everything. Well, okay, can we do that? So we looked at the right balance for that, and then the packaging and the size of fit, you know, what we can fit into the battery space we had now without tearing it all apart. And we thought we found that, right? The 150-mile range. The price is going to come down a little bit, yet it's all new styling, lots of new features that we'll talk about. And so we did that. The reality is, though, we know what's going on in the market, right? We know that, you know, you can read or you can study your customers and said, what's going to take to have a seamless experience compared to a gas car? And maybe exactly the same range would be the first step, right? And so that's where, you know, maybe that's where we need to go. And what's the right number? Is it 300 miles? Is it 400? Whatever it is. But so the fact is, we know that, and we're going to come up with a battery with a range that's going to, you know, push 200 plus, and it's going to be, you know, in that competitive space. But it can't be for the same price, right?
Sure.
We're all working together to get that, you know, price down of the batteries, and I think the volume as it comes up is helping that. But you know, it's not. It's going to take more. You know.
Do you see that on the horizon? The battery prices coming down consistently, because obviously they don't change as much as Moore's law changed the computing power. We wish
did,
but they don't. It's much more incremental than that. How has that been going?
Well, you know, we have a lot of different research like everyone's doing, and, you know, whether it's solid state or other things like that. In reality, I mean, you can read in the paper about the fluctuation of cobalt prices. I think I read yesterday about how Apple's trying to secure their, the source pipeline there. And I think, you know, engineers are pretty creative, and so are the kind of accountants of the company. So, you know, whether it's a catalytic converter that palladium prices are going through the roof, we have to reduce that. And the same thing goes for the rare earth elements that are in batteries and all that. So I think we're definitely working on that, and we're trying to make it optimum to find the right balance of source, supply, cost, all that. But I mean, I think even with the current lithium ion structure, the price is coming down, and you know, that $100 kilowatt hour, that's achievable. I think it is a lot faster than we thought originally because everyone's working on it. And, you know, in the case of Nissan, I mean, we within the last year, I forgot the exact date, you know, where we kind of separated ourselves from the battery. Because in the beginning when we started, there was nobody doing it. So we had to do it ourselves and integrate it to our system. But we realized that we don't have we're not going to be able to develop the kind of the power of efficiency of size. And you know, by making a battery or a product that can go to in other industries and everything, so that pricing accelerate and go faster. So we kind of recognized that, and we decided that we need to kind of separate ourselves from it. And yet, still research, though. We're researching, the next generation batteries all the time, and we've got guys in Farmington Hills here doing the same thing, and looking at, continuing our kind of safety record and the things that we've been, you know, kind of known for.
Have you guys gotten your hands on a Model 3 Tesla yet to look at, to tear apart, to compare and test?
Well, that's funny. I literally was signing some purchase orders this week to get one. And
how much you paying?
Oh, that's well. Let's say slightly over list.
Okay. Additional dealer markup, as they used to say.
Yes. I mean, we had a bunch of guys that work in the company out in Sacramento and others that were so excited about it. They put their name on that list right away when that came out for that $1,000, put on their own personal credit cards, et cetera. But, you know, we've kind of seen that those guys are still getting bumped down the list a little bit. So we're excited about it, though. When I was out in Sacramento, and we've got an office out there, and we're very connected to the EV world, and there's an EV, like a Sacramento EV club that gets together, and we sometimes host them at our facility, and just because it's great for community and connecting with people, and it's not just about Leafs, it's about all the EV drivers. And I was out there about a month or two ago, and we were able to see one of the guys in that club has a Model X, and got at the front of the line to get your Model 3, because I think there's a little bit of a prioritization there for current owners, which is pretty cool. So got to look at it up close, touch it, and see what's going on with it. But we'll be driving one soon and doing some of our own kind of competitive analysis of it.
Chris, getting back to the Leaf, okay, this just isn't an electric car. You guys have other technologies in this that I think are sort of interesting. Talk about some of those aspects, whether it's the e-pedal or the autonomous capabilities that are in this car.
Well, it's a good point, Gary. So what we really, we've announced recently, right, kind of our strategy, our goal, our roadmap going forward. It's called Nissan Intelligent Mobility. So, and what is that? Well, we're trying to get to zero emission and zero fatality. And so what better car should be the kind of symbolic car of that? This is actually, before I go any further, I got to tell you a funny story. So we had the launch party in the office recently, right? So it's a celebration, right? We got through the start of production. We got to we call it DJM, Delivery Judgment Meeting, where they're actually at the dealers, right? It's been 2 or 3 weeks they've been at the dealers. So we have a celebration for that, commend all the engineers, tell stories about the development, that kind of stuff. So, and at the same time, we've got this philosophy, right, this intelligent mobility philosophy that we're rolling out and trying to be consistent the way we talk about all the products, and this is the first one. So we've been doing a lot of internal communication, and I'm pretty proud of it. I'm actually kind of leading it, so I'm talking to the CorpCom people, the communications people, and we're kind of bragging about how many activities we've had, and we're looking at some kind of rating chart, which is all smiley faces. Oh, we did this. We had 14 activities. We did this and this and this. And so then there was a setup about its intelligent mobility in our office, and it was off to the side. And I said, we're getting ready to have this presentation. I think we should all be around the Leaf, and it should be there, and everybody's going to be talking, and we're going to be getting some excitement. And so my team was like, we've been talking about it so much. I don't think it should be the mainstream. I think we should focus more on the car. I said, all right, I'll tell you what. We'll just grab a couple of people as they're walking by in the hallway, and we'll just see how it works. So, I grabbed somebody who was walking by, and I was like, hey. I was like, Ed, come over here. I was like, and literally the Leaf is behind us. We've got these banners on the wall that talk about this intelligent mobility and this connection we're all proud of. And I'm like, hey, Ed, can you tell me two things? One, any one of the pillars that we've talked about so much about intelligent mobility, and then what car do you think would be the most symbolic car ever to represent intelligent mobility? And then he was a little bit nervous. I mean, it was no cameras or anything, but he was like staring at me like, and he's like, the QX50? That's like close, because that's an Infiniti. He's in charge of that. I give him credit. He's a good guy, and he's working super hard on that project. And I was like, you're close, but we're talking Nissan Intelligent Mobility. And so he's a little bit, deer in the headlights look. And I was like, okay, how about this? One of the pillars. And he's like, I don't know. So I was like, okay, I think we need to do a better job here. So anyways, we brought all the stuff into the front. We brought the Leaf in there. We had a good explanation. We're going to keep driving that message home. But so now back to your question. So now we've got intelligent mobility, and we've got drive and power and integration and all that. So this car is capturing that. So I'm trying to get used to every time I explain something about the car, I've got to connect back to that vision of zero fatalities and zero emission. So on the zero fatality side, this is one of the cars that has that. So Nissan Intelligent Drive, in that category, we talk about kind of confidence of the drive. And so our ProPilot Assist, so our first step into autonomous drive is launched on the new Leaf. So, and the other is going to be the e-pedal, the one-pedal drive, the e-pedal. Those we're going to put in that kind of confident, connected.
And explain how the e-pedal works. What's the driving experience?
Well, it's actually pretty amazing. Besides the fact that one time I was explaining to somebody and they said, you're only going to have one pedal? They're like, oh, no, not quite yet. We're going to ramp into that. Two pedals, but you use one. You use the accelerator pedal. And as we talked earlier, it's about the balance between what makes an EV an EV? What gives you the advantage of quick feedback from the pedal, quick action on the car, at the same time regenerative braking. So put that together is what you get. And, I think we drove it out in Napa. We've driven it all over the place, on the hills of San Francisco, out in Napa, everywhere. And you can get a very dynamic, like kind of a give-and-take relationship with the car where, you'd think it would take a while to get used to, but literally with almost zero explanation in a matter of minutes, you can get comfortable. Driving on a city street, stop-and-go traffic following. But basically it's about when you take your foot off the pedal, the car starts to slow down. It's like a 0.2G. It's right in the right balance point where it's not jerky or anything, but you feel this sensation that you can time it very, very easily, a little faster than you'd slow down regular, a little bit more feedback, but that's why it gives you confidence that you can go stop and go on traffics in a city and be able to understand that, I can just let this off and feel natural. My wife's not looking at me like, why are you jerking the car so much? And it's basically connected to the car, stop and go, one pedal.
So Would someone use their break ordinarily, or have you guys found that once someone gets familiar with the way this accelerator pedal also works, it's braking, that
they just think you're going to use your brake pedal anymore. Mm-hmm. I mean, I look at the way I use cruise control.
It depends on how you drive it, really. I mean, I would just insert that if you tend to drive really fast and really aggressively, there are going to be situations where you have to stop really fast. If you're sort of a more sedate driver and you just accelerate easily and then brake more easily, I agree with you. You're probably not going to use the brake very much at all.
But if you're tearing in and out of... You're going to learn. If you're in stop-and-go traffic and you realize, oh, I got to slow down, as soon as you take your foot off the gas pedal, as it were, the car will start to slow down enough where you go, oh, I don't even have to put my foot on the brake. The car will teach you how to drive it, at least in stop-and-go.
Well, I mean, you're right. I think that there is going to be, you can do it in stop and go, but we took it out and on some really fun roads where you're kind of really going through the corners and kind of getting that balance of how much gas to put, how much brake to put, and you can be pretty aggressive. Reality is, yeah, I mean, you got to remember, there is a brake pedal when you want to be aggressive and stop quick.
Somebody, a pedestrian jumps out in front of you. Don't wait for the e-pedal to save you. It's not going to. Well, it's, you know, you laugh, but you have to realize that thing is there.
You're absolutely right. I mean, it's going to work just like a regular car. But
we're going from two pedals to one pedal to zero pedals, right?
That's right, exactly. Fold out, you know, steering wheel, put it away, put out, take out the laptop.
Okay, another question. Going back to the car itself, you guys built a battery plant in Smyrna, Tennessee. You're selling it, though, right?
Yeah.
Or have you sold it already?
We officially sold it.
Okay, is it making batteries for this car, the new Leaf?
It is. It absolutely is.
Okay. And is this car made in Tennessee?
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, we have two major plants in the U.S. and a few in Mexico, and we've got the Smyrna, Tennessee plant, Canton, Mississippi. So Mississippi was the one where the Murano was built, and then this is the Smyrna plant. So it's about an hour south of Nashville. And it's a mammoth plant. I think it's the biggest output plant in the U.S. It's like 650,000 cars a year.
Yeah.
And the uniqueness of it is how many different types of cars come down the same lines. I mean, there's pre-lines that feed into the finals. But between the, you've got the Maxima, the Altima, the Rogue. We've got some of my other products, the QX60, the Pathfinder. And then you've got the Leaf. So the Leaf is made in Tennessee.
That's amazing.
Is that a dedicated platform? Or is it shared with something else?
It's dedicated. It's a dedicated EV platform. You know, and we've announced that we're going to do a lot more EV going forward. And, of course, that, you know, when you only have one, it's fairly dedicated. But in reality, you know, just like the Murano kind of had a kind of an SUV dedicated platform, but reality is you're trying to take commonality from your others. So even from the sedans, we grab the side members and then we make a little bit beefier of this. But, you know, this one has got some elements that are common, but basically dedicated platform.
And so... Your alliance partner, Renault, has a number of EVs. Is it share anything with the Renault products?
Well, it's interesting. The alliance is coming together, you know, more and more. And then we're sharing a lot of things. You know, Carlos Ghosn has talked about a lot of that, the synergies that we're getting. And you're starting to see it more and more. Now, the fact is, being in the U.S. market without Renault being here, it's been less and less. I mean, obviously, you look in Europe, you look in Brazil, you look in, you know, Mexico, you look in China, all that, where there's a lot more, you know, reasons to be, you know, share things. But so the reality is the Zoe, which is the equivalent there, is different. But, you know, in the future, there'll be a lot more collaboration going forward. Mm-hmm. I think it was really the kind of not really opposing objectives, but the competitiveness of the two teams trying to come up with their own solutions. And sometimes that's really good. Sometimes it'll be less efficient. So, you know, we're trying to kind of find the best of both worlds. So we're not too big. We're agile, yet we shouldn't duplicate things either.
Mm-hmm. Hey, we got a bunch of questions here. We're not going to be able to get to all of them from the audience, but Joe Laszlo wants to know, are you doing anything to recycle or repurpose the batteries from the older Leafs?
Well, we absolutely are. I mean, we see that as a huge thing, and we're coming very soon with some really, really cool products. And one of the things, it's in an intelligent mobility world of pillars, it's an intelligent integration, and that comes back to how to connect the Leaf to society, and that would include things like the battery and the batteries that are being have kind of gone beyond their life from a vehicle standpoint, but they're out. And, you know, we're studying a lot of that, right? The point is, one of it is to recycle, and recycling is a lot of different things, right? You can take a battery cell pack and look at we're going from 48 to 24, these big internal packs. You can look at pack by pack and where they are, from the durability standpoint, they age differently. And so you can, one of the things we're doing, you take out the good cells and take the bad cells, but I mean cells that aren't quite at the right level, into like a different pile in a sense. And, you know, we're studying things that we can do to integrate that, whether it's backup for home and other kinds of things. And that vehicle-to-home connection or future power pack to home. And, I mean, we're definitely studying a lot of that stuff and using, you know, battery backups.
Tucker from Albuquerque says, by the way, he owns a 2013 Leaf and absolutely loves it. But he wants to know that, he says, some people say you get most out of the charging using only a level one and charging it to 80%. Others say that you have to use a level two to maintain your batteries. He wants to know what's the best practice for taking care of your batteries.
Well, we've studied it a lot, and we definitely made improvements to the durability this time. You know, we've got an 8-year, 100,000-mile warranty on it. It's a new chemistry. We've done a lot. So it's very funny, actually, because my wife and I argue about this all the time, even about the cell phone, about how to use a cell phone. And I'm convinced, cell phones and laptops, I'm convinced personally, no matter what anybody says, you charge it to full, you work it till it's empty, and then you charge it again. So that's my experience with laptops and my argument with my wife. At the same time with the car, we've done a lot of work to know that this thing needs to be charged every night. Needs to be, and the point is to have the best utilization of the car. So you wake up with a full battery. So we know that that's going to be the best mannerism. But, I mean, really, we like the level two charger, but, I mean, we're not differentiating between from the battery usage standpoint. We want customers to be able to use it any way they want. And that's one of the points that we added on this one. We have a level one, level two charger in the car itself. I think it's an option, but basically so you can actually plug into a 110 outlet or a 220 outlet, like a dryer outlet, basically, and be able to charge your car when you're driving around, and it's more portable that way. At the same time, you can have the level two charger installed in your house.
And speaking of the batteries, Stefan or Steven wants to know, can older Leafs get their batteries upgraded with this new one?
Well, I think in reality, batteries can be replaced as a fact. But the system itself, the combination of the inverter and everything together is a full system. So you need to look at, you can get a new battery, you can kind of reborn your own car, but it's a different system.
So you need to buy more than just the battery in order to
use
the new battery.
Exactly.
So you might as well just buy a new Leaf.
That's right. Exactly.
Michael Check wants to know, what about an all-wheel drive variant?
Well,
he, by the way, also has owned a Leaf for 4 years and loves it.
Okay. Well, we liked it. A lot of good shout-outs there. We love that. We know that in the future, we know, especially in the north, people like all-wheel drive cars, right? And we're talking about coming out with all-wheel drive on the Altima and that kind of stuff. So we're doing some new things there. In the future, we're definitely attacking that. We know that you're going to need a combination of all-wheel drive and battery and different combinations of cars. Not on the horizon right this minute, but being studied very seriously. It's going to come.
This is front drive?
Yeah.
Let's see. And Joe Laszlo wants to know, is this powertrain scalable for other body styles and applications?
Well, I think, as we're getting ready to, expand our lineup of EVs, there's definitely scalability coming, and from the battery. And in reality is, in some degrees, we're going to be increasing the capability of the system as we go to the next size battery that we're already doing for the coming up within a year, as we increase the range. So from that standpoint, I think it's a lot more plug and play in a sense compared to a conventional powertrain. Definitely have a lot of options.
Noceum writes in to say, Christopher, please talk about the soundproofing. What's that about?
The soundproofing. Well, being with a Leaf or with an EV, right? You really get to take advantage of the noise characteristics of the powertrain, obviously. So we did a lot, really raised the bar on the new Leaf, and it starts really from the fundamental styling and the aerodynamics, because aerodynamics lead to noise and wind noise. I know that just from the we did things like we lowered the CD, not significantly, but we focused on the CD and wind noise at the same time. And things like the headlamps, even that the bug eye lamps in the past, those things contributed to a little bit to noise. And so the combination, the balance of how the air comes off those and hits the mirrors, all that stuff. So we started from the fundamental styling design, optimized the CD with the intention of noise, and then things like laminated glass and other things, and then more the noise package. We really, really raised the bar as far as the customer feeling and experience, from road noise, wind noise.
So for people who haven't driven an EV before, they probably don't realize that because it's so quiet, you're not hearing the engine noise, that you hear all kinds of external noises, and that's why you guys had to address these things.
Totally a balance issue, right? You can see, we've taken, ICE, internal combustion engines, and put a lot of stuff on the front of the car, all of a sudden the back sounds terrible, right? Or the balance is so important. So, yeah, as far as that goes, first of all, you don't have any distraction, as you said, from the engine. And so that full balance and then that raising the bar on it is so critical. Otherwise, you don't get the value of what you're getting. I mean, like we were talking about the aggregate roads in Texas, and that kind of road noise input becomes more critical. Mm-hmm.
Have you thought about noise cancellation at all? Does that become really too expensive and impractical for a vehicle of this price?
Well, yeah, in reality, it is it's a little pricey. But we've been thinking about a lot of cool ideas for bringing good noises into the car and also canceling the bad noises. So it's being studied for sure. And the reality is, when you're trying to come in under $30,000, you got to be practical with what you're choosing. But I think there's opportunity there that we're studying.
Real good. We're going to have to wrap this segment up. But
great.
Chris Reed, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Right.
Always a pleasure to have
really
you here.
Really enjoyed it.
It's
thanks for all
great
the questions.
To take a dive into what the Leaf is all about. Mm-hmm. But right now, we're going to take a quick commercial break, and we're going to give a shout-out to our friends at Bridgestone. And we have a promo of some upcoming show that we want you to learn about as well.
You may have seen them at top-notch trade shows around the country or sat on them in a friend's car. Catskin, the premier manufacturer of custom leather interiors, has teamed up with Autoline to give away a free brand new interior for your vehicle. Go to our website, autoline.tv, to enter. Good luck.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Can I get one of those free interiors?
Yeah. friends and family. All right. Yeah.
Just checking.
Yeah. Well, as everybody knows, this is the part of the show. We do have a Dr. Data.
We do have a Dr.
Okay.
We have a Dr. Data.
Drum roll, please. Dr. Data, the stage is yours.
Okay, so as you may recall, last week we mixed it up a little bit, and we basically, had something get increased, decreased, stay the same.
I'm always mixed up when I talk to you.
Okay. So we're going to do this time. I'm making it incredibly easy because I knew that.
I'd be on the show.
No, I didn't say that. So John, you are always looking at the picture to try to figure out.
I know.
The numbers.
So now you've.
So now this is going to be dead simple. So I'm going to. You're going to see the picture, and the number is going to be a date, and I want you to tell me who it is, and why it's significant.
Ooh.
So, Carmen, please bring the first image up.
I know who that is.
Oh. All right,
that's a very rare picture of this guy, too, by the way.
So Derone.
He's Italian.
He's a very good guess.
He's Italian.
Very good guess. And he's generally shot with sunglasses or some sort of glasses that mm-hmm. don't show his eyes.
That's right.
And that's why I say this is a very rare photo, because you rarely see a picture of this guy without any kind of glasses on.
February 18th, 1898.
98.
I give up.
So you on both counts?
Yeah.
Okay. And so what's your sense of what this would be?
My sense is it's probably some sort of speed record in an old car or some sort of distance.
Endurance record, maybe.
It's either endurance, right, that they were able to drive X kilometers, or he set some speed, 100 kilometers an hour or something like that.
And I'm glad to say that you're wrong.
Oh, damn it!
So you know who it is. So, Carmen, bring up the answer. So that's Enzo Ferrari. He was born 120 years ago.
Okay.
You got the Italian part right.
Right.
So last week it was, Sunday was his birthday.
He's got a characteristically Italian face.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, the dark
so
hair.
That, so I, because here we are with, today's the 22nd, and I just figured, this week.
Yeah,
Enzo's sort of
thing. Enzo Ferrari.
And I also discovered, while I was doing a little research on this, and you realize that the prancing horse that's used in the Ferrari logo is used in what other logo?
Prancing horse. Is it an automotive logo?
Yes.
Yeah.
It is.
And it's very surprising.
Lamborghini?
No.
No. Which is a good guess, though.
Yeah.
I want to say Baojun.
No.
What?
Porsche.
What?
Yeah, there's a horse in there. That's right. I knew it was
a little
exotic.
Crest.
Yeah.
I hadn't thought of that.
I knew there was another course. There was another exotic that used that. Mm-hmm. I remember stopping and thinking of that, but I'd forgotten it was Porsche. Yeah.
You know,
good.
I think I might have had the. I don't know this for a fact, but I'm awfully close. I think I had the last public interview that Enzo Ferrari ever did.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Ferrari had invited a very small group of American journalists over there, and we met as part of a trip, a deep dive into the company, all their manufacturing, design, engineering, da-da-da-da-da. And at the end of the whole tour, they said, oh, now you get to meet Mr. Ferrari. And we all went into this room, little room, because it was a small group. And there was Enzo Ferrari.
Wow.
And we all just sat there, mouths agape. Oh, my God, it's the man.
You didn't come over there with the promise that you were going to get to meet him. That was
No.
That was a bonus.
Total surprise. And we were just sitting there dumbfounded. And he's, like, expecting these journalists to start asking him questions. Mm-hmm. And we're just sort of staring at this icon. And we didn't say anything. So he just started telling stories.
Wow.
And it was hilarious. A couple of the stories were absolutely hilarious. Mm-hmm. And one of the highlights of my career was absolutely. And once he started telling stories and then paused after a while, that broke the ice. And we started asking him all kinds of stupid questions, you know, who was your favorite race driver kind of stuff. And but it was cool to get to meet Enzo.
So Daron, you cover business and you're rather well connected in that whole area. So, I mean, what is your take on the way that Sergio has been handling Ferrari by, you know, spinning it off and having it separate? Was that a good idea?
First of all, you don't really have to ask whether it's a good idea. You look at the value of the company and you decide whether it was a good idea or not. Mm-hmm. And based on that, it was brilliant. I mean, the market, I don't know what the last and final numbers are. I didn't come prepared for that. But the last I looked, it was
worth more than FCA.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was a tremendous idea, and it's worked out very, very well. So it's very smart. I think generally I've been a big fan of Sergio's from the start. He's done more, and I've said this many times to many people who've asked me, I think he's done more with the cards he's been dealt than anybody else in Detroit. Mm-hmm. Maybe Mary Barr is now beginning to approach that, but he's had a long run. We've been really fortunate to see a lot of great CEOs in our time. Ghosn has been good. Mary Barr has been good. Sergio has been terrific as well.
So I also heard today is Reid Biglund's birthday, and you and I were talking about Reid Biglund a little bit.
We know Sergio retires at the end of this year. The speculation is running rampant.
It's a mystery now, so what's going to happen?
Who's going to replace him? And Reid Biglund is one of the people on the list, obviously.
And he's been on After Hours, so that is a feather in his cap.
That qualifies him on the company.
Yeah, because, you know, just like a few weeks before Mark Fields became chairman of Ford, he was on After Hours.
Did you mention him because you think he's going to be the person? Or just that he's
speculating. Candidate, what do you think?
I don't really follow it that closely, but I think he certainly has been a candidate. This guy, Mike Manley, has been a candidate at Jeep. I think whoever it is going to have big shoes to fill because I think that Sergio operates at a level that a lot of people
nobody else.
No. I mean, he's just thinking so many steps ahead, and he's just got such a nimble mind that it's going to be tough to replace him. And I think that it's happened a lot in American corporations and in the automobile industry that you've had companies that had a good run because they've been fortunate to have a really terrific CEO. And then afterwards, it's tough to replace that CEO.
Mm-hmm.
Really is. And I think they're going to have a different management structure because Sergio's got, 24 direct reports? I don't think that's going to stand with whoever the next CEO is.
Nobody will be able to do that.
They'll whittle that down to about 8, which means there's going to be a lot of changes all the way down the structure.
Sure, sure. And I know you manage the discussion, but this is a sort of a logical segue to...
It is.
Yeah, I wonder where you're going with this one.
Ford, yeah, what do you make?
This has been a big week. All of a sudden, one of the top people at Ford Motor Company kind of mysteriously against a backdrop of self-admitted inappropriate behavior, and we don't know what that is.
Yeah, and we're talking about Raj Nair, the president of Ford's North American operations.
Top people, and now has been replaced by Kumar Galhotra, who has really made kind of a meteoric rise. I mean, when we knew him a year ago, he was running the Lincoln Motor Car Company, and then it's sort of head of all marketing, and now it's a big North American job. So he's moving up quickly, and, you know, there's always drama at the Ford Motor Company.
Yeah, Kumar's familiar to people who watch the show, and he's been on two or three times at least. And, you know, it's always interesting to me to realize that Kumar is an engineer, yet he seems so
worldly.
That's a good way of putting it. No, absolutely.
He comes across more as a businessman.
He has more cosmopolitan taste, let's say, than most engineers we know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would have thought he was a marketing guy. I mean, if I didn't know that that's what he is. And
the other move that I found interesting was the person who replaced Kumar at Lincoln, Joy Falotico.
Yes.
And what I find intriguing, I don't know anything about her, to be honest. I don't think I've ever met her. But she comes out of Ford Credit. She had been running that.
Yeah.
So here's presumably somebody with a finance background that's now been put in charge of Lincoln and has been named the chief marketing officer of the company, which I find fascinating, and retains her board position at Ford Credit. Hmm. So here's a woman who's really rocketing up the ranks, but I find that fascinating that, if I'm right, somebody with a financial background has been named CMO.
Sounds like a good idea for a guest here.
Sure does. Oh, yeah. We'll have to get her on.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what's your take on that? I mean, to have a person who was the CEO of Ford Credit to run Lincoln.
Well, I sort of step back and look at the whole situation at Ford more holistically. And, you know, you have Jim Hackett coming in here. He hasn't really even been here for a year. And there's been so much turmoil in other spots that I think that it gives pause for worry at Ford Motor Company, not because any of these people are lacking in their abilities, but because it's the nature of this game is that if you disrupt the progression of development of a vehicle because you have to change the leader or because everybody's wondering now what to do, this sort of process goes down the line and it causes delays, it causes mistakes, and car companies can't, certainly not Ford, but no car company can really afford that. So you really need a kind of consistency of leadership in order to bring these cars out on time and under budget and in a way that aligns with consumer taste. So I worry a little bit about that.
No, I think you're spot on with that. You know, Ford's having a hard time explaining to the analysts where it's going and how it's going to make money with what it's doing.
And then there was this other thing in China where this guy, Jason Luo, who all of a sudden
abruptly resigned
because of some personal reason, again, sort of a little bit of an air of mystery, something that happened before, you know, has to do with something before he came to Ford, they were quick to say. But what is that about? Now, Ford was behind in China. We know that. It got a late start in China, and now they're changing leaders again. And they cannot really afford to be behind too long in China. You know, give General Motors a lot of credit for seeing the value of China and realizing that. And we can see that now play out as China is the biggest auto market in the world.
Well, it's interesting that another change that happened is a guy named John Lawler is appointed vice president of strategy. And he had previously served as chairman and CEO of Ford China, and Lawler will support the aforementioned Jim Hackett, the CEO, in advancing the global initiatives underway to dramatically improve Ford's operational fitness. So what do you think that means?
That means he gets the big axe.
Well, I think fitness
he gets
and axe.
To use the big axe.
Yes,
he doesn't.
Fitness and axe go together. I mean, this is a euphemism for having to trim the organization and reorganize it and lower costs. And I think everybody's probably apprehensive at Ford about how that's going to happen and how it's going to affect their jobs, as I would be if I was working at the Ford Motor Company right now. But it's got to happen.
Yeah, because one of the things that Hackett had done at Steelcase was really reduce headcount and plants and just, you know, to make it a smaller, more nimble company, and we haven't seen any big change at Ford yet.
But they've been pretty open. Didn't they come out and say they were going to take $10 billion in costs out, and it was going to be, part of it was going to be materials, which scares the hell out of suppliers because that implies they're going to be getting the squeeze. A lot of it was talked about engineering costs, but as you guys know, the fastest way to chop cost out of a car company is get rid of models. And when you look at the fact that passenger sedans are going through the drain, down the drain right now. It's pretty obviously, to me at least, I think, that's where the real cuts are going to come at first.
Well, the famous quote is Henry Ford II, the late Henry Ford II used to say, costs come into your office on two legs. So the cars are changing. And this is not because necessarily Ford is bloated or it's lost control of itself. But when you change strategy and you change the types of cars you're building and you change the types of materials and you change what your investment patterns and strategy is, that inevitably means that some people are going to go. It means you may be hiring, but you may be hiring different people with different kinds of abilities.
Mm-hmm. Right. Hey, plenty more to talk about, but we got to take another commercial break, and we're going to give a shout out to our good friends at Lear.
Lear Kinexus offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts. All delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Okay, we're back. Autoline After Hours, talking all things automotive.
So there was an interesting thing I thought happened this week. We're talking about suppliers and things that are changing up, and Bosch, one of the world's leading, if not the world's leading tier one supplier, bought this startup company, Splitting Fares, a Detroit technology-based startup company that basically is a ride-sharing app that businesses would have their employees use. So it's Lyft and Uber-like, except for the fact of if you and I were going to work at the same place, you'd go on your phone and call us up, and I'd go on my phone and call us up, and John, you go on your phone and call it up, and it would figure out the best way to get us there. And so suddenly you have a supplier that has historically been selling things to the auto industry is now getting into services in the auto industry in a big way, which seems to me that in some ways might be competitive with a Lyft, which General Motors owns a part of, or a Maven, which General Motors owns outright, or Chariot, which Ford Motor Company owns outright. I mean, what's going on here?
Well, I think that the analogy is what you've seen at Delphi. Delphi actually decided it was going to go deep into the future mobility business. And so you saw them buy into a number of these types of firms. And I'm sure Bosch was watching this and saying, you know what, we should be selling services too. And like you say, there's no reason why we shouldn't compete with the automakers. The automakers are competing with companies like Lyft. And if they don't compete with companies like Lyft, they'll be put out of business. Mm-hmm. I mean, they won't be able to offer these. It's pretty clear that the school of thought that says that the future of mobility is not necessarily owning your own car. It's being able to buy mobility as a service.
Owning your own phone.
Owning your own phone. Well, we already have our own phones. Some of us have many phones, but you're buying mobility as a service, and the ability to do that with a purchase like Bosch has made. All of these ride hailing, ride sharing, they're very similar services. They take this and they match it with some hardware and some software, and then away you go. It sounds like a smart move for Bosch and probably one that didn't cost it all that much money.
It seems to me they're a first mover in this space, though, because, I mean, Aptiv, that's the Delphi...
Delphi part of the broker.
Delphi 2.0.
Yes.
They have bought all these things, but they're not quite yet offering a service. And Glenn DeVos, who's the chief technology officer over there, I was talking to him, and he basically was alluding to the fact that, you know, they may develop entire autonomous systems that they would... like sell or lease to say municipalities yeah. that could run fleets that Aptiv would basically own and then get the data and so on. And I mean, Continental has systems, but they're running around their own campus. Now these guys are going outside the wall,
yeah,
right?
No, I think it's fascinating. And you're right, Gary. I don't think any other supplier has made this kind of move. They've gone out and bought technology, whether it's a LiDAR startup or, you know, some sensor technology or things like that. But to get into actual mobility services, I'm intrigued by that. And I'd love to we got to get somebody in from Bosch to be able to talk about that on this show, because the way I see it, what Bosch is looking at is, to your point, Gary, all this mobility stuff, everyone's starting from scratch. Anyone can win in this game. Mm-hmm. Just because you're a General Motors or a Toyota or a Waymo or a Mobileye, nothing's guaranteed here. And I think what Bosch is recognizing is, hey, here's a niche, what we can play at, companies trying to do good for their employees by figuring out how they can commute back and forth very efficiently. So they're not really going out there competing against General Motors with Maven, not competing against Uber and Lyft. They have found a subset. I think it's an intriguing move.
Upside to them in the long run?
I think Bosch has a lot of credibility in this area. It's not like this was, they were making vegetable oil or something and they decided to get into this. Bosch has a long, storied history in transportation. I'm sure they'll do well. I can't wait to see the show when you get somebody from them to come and talk about it. I think it's probably going to be a while before they're prepared to talk about it, because I'm not sure they know exactly what to do with it yet.
Mm-hmm. Now we've talked recently on the show about the change that's been occurring at General Motors. General Motors, selling Vauxhall and Opel off and pulling out of some markets. And so this week, there was news about GM Korea. And so General Motors basically proposing that they'd invest $2.8 billion over 10 years in Korea to keep that business going. What do you think, Daron?
Well, I think, first of all, a lot of that is contingent on what the government wants to do. So that's part of the investment. The other part is they're expecting the government to put some money in this, too.
Because the government basically owns 17% of GM Korea, which I didn't realize. So it's through the Korean Development Bank.
Right.
So they're saying, yeah, you guys have to kick in. They're looking for $476 million to
right.
do that.
And as part of this deal, there's a plant going to be closing, and GM wants that to happen under relatively peaceful conditions. So it's holding out this investment and telling them that, hey, we can invest here, or maybe we can invest someplace else. You decide, but we need to unwind from this plant, and so we don't want this under a cloud of acrimony. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very much reflective of sort of the new practical, hard-eyed thinking of General Motors, which we've seen in other parts of the world, and which is very much favored now by the owners, by people on Wall Street. The stock has been doing relatively well. They'd like better prices than they've been getting, but they've been getting better prices than they had been getting just because the management of GM, led by Mary Barra, has been willing to say, look, if we're not making money there, we're going to have to change the conditions however we need to change them so that we do make money there.
You told me a funny line yesterday about what General Motors had been characterized by some people as being.
Oh, it's I think when we were pups in this business, we used to refer to this as the United States Department of Personal Transportation. Nobody really thought of it as a business. It was kind of beside the point whether they made money or lost money or how much. It was just kind of part of America, maybe the fifth estate or the sixth estate, something that we did. But obviously, the bankruptcy changed all that, and it's a much more vibrant, I would argue, a much more competitive company now, and to everybody's benefit.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about what they're doing?
Well, I pretty much echo what Daron said. General Motors is looking at all of its businesses. If they're not making money or making good returns, it's either going to change it or get out. And, they got out of Europe. South Korea GM operations made most of the cars that were going to Europe. The Chevrolets that were sold in Europe were all coming out of South Korea. They don't need that anymore. They've pulled out of about six other markets worldwide that Korea also sold. The Korean won is growing in strength against the dollar. Korean wages are going up. It's no longer the low-cost country that it was even 10 years ago. And General Motors has said, we don't see how we're going to turn this around. So, plus, it's got a lot of debt, and they don't want to pay down that debt, although the deal, I guess, is they're going to pay it off in stock if the deal goes through. And I think we're going to see more of this around from GM. Now, having said that, I think what they're really looking at is the assembly operations, because remember, GM DAT, D-A-T, Daewoo Automotive Technologies, that's the official name of it, does a lot of engineering. Pretty much all the small cars in, small vehicles in GM are designed there. I'll bet it doesn't want to get rid of that operation. But as far as the manufacturing goes, either its Korean partners, stakeholders, including the union there, is going to have to step up and say, here's the plan to make money here again, or they're just going to pull out.
Yeah, and this is not only a philosophical point on the part of General Motors. General Motors really has to conserve its resources because the amount of money that they need to invest to get into future mobility systems is immense. I mean, it's just going to be more and more and more. And we've seen this. This comes in not even $100 million increments. This is in billion-dollar increments. And I think that General Motors has really put a flag in the ground that it plans to be a leader in the future of mobility, and that's going to be expensive.
So when you say the future of mobility, are you talking about autonomous vehicles, electric vehicles, both,
all of
services?
It. All of it. Yeah, it's autonomous, it's electric, it's ride hailing, it's ride sharing, it's maybe selling rides, not selling cars. I mean, all of the car companies now, and I think this is fascinating, are beginning to really experiment with, you see, Book by Cadillac, where they have a subscription service. You see, we saw at Volvo,
Care
we were all
Volvo.
There, they have this Care by Volvo, which is kind of a leasing, a different
subscription.
Leasing. Subscription, they call it subscription. It's really leasing of a different flavor, but packaging, financing, and you have to qualify for financing, and you package the insurance inside of it. But the point is, everybody has to be much more open-minded about how these various schemes are going to work, because it's really the consumer that's in the driver's seat, and consumers really will dictate in what way this will all unfold. But autonomous is a big part of it, obviously, as well.
So if General Motors needs to invest, you know, cubic acres of cash in order to do things like that. Okay, what happens to companies like FCA that don't seem to have that same capability? Throw weight, as it were.
Yeah, I mean, they can't match the investments. They don't have the opportunity to match the investments of General Motors, you know, dollar for dollar, but they're going to have to be creative about how they do it. They're just going to have to, sometimes they're going to have to be the supplier, sometimes they're going to have to be the customer, and they're going to have to probably collaborate, you know, as they did with Waymo.
Yeah, and exactly. That's the way I think they're going to go. The companies with the deep pockets, the GMs, the Toyotas, the Daimlers, they're going to do all this in-house. They can do it. Companies like FCA and others don't have the resources to do it.
You know, if you're Mazda, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
Okay, so will there be consolidation? I mean, we've long thought that there'd be, you know, a
I don't think there's going to be consolidation from this standpoint. I think these companies, a lot of these companies are just going to go out of business. There's way too many car companies. There's way too many models. And as we move into this future of ride hailing and ride sharing, we're just not going to need as many cars.
All right, who's going away?
Well, you know, the ones who don't have the resources to invest in this new technology. But I will say this, it's going to be a while. It's going to be a decade before all these investments in electrification. Everyone's losing lots of money on electrification right now. There's no... Everyone can talk about, oh, the price of batteries is going down and all that, but they're losing money on every car. And Sergio, to cite him, has said, you know, we lose $14,000 on every electric Fiat 500e that
we sell. Please don't buy them.
Yeah.
Well,
we don't see a business case for it.
They don't have much of a problem with that.
He's also said he doesn't see a business case yet for autonomous cars. So, you know, there's something to be said possibly about being, you know, second to
late
the party.
But right.
Late but right.
Yeah.
But having said that, I still believe that we're not going to have the need for as many cars in the future as we have right now. If all this ride sharing and ride hailing really catches on, we're not going to need as many car companies.
Daron, do you think that we're going to lose some car companies in 10 years?
You know, when you say lose car companies, I mean, car companies merge with one another, and one name stays around for a while, and then it disappears. You don't really feel like you lost it. It just sort of got absorbed by a bigger car company. But that's the way all businesses are, is that the winners are able to absorb the losers, and that will happen.
So I'm just going to throw one out. Will Subaru exist in 10 years? as we know it, versus as being a wholly owned subsidiary of fill in the blank.
The Toyota Motor Corporation. I mean, it's already sort of in their
Toyota
in their,
owns a chunk of both Subaru and Mazda.
Exactly.
So they're kind of protected because they got the mothership in Nagoya.
That's and they don't have to be instructed by the Japanese government that that they want this, you know, for purposes of harmony. They don't want these companies to get in trouble. Mm-hmm. So things that they can't do because of their small scale, Toyota is going to help them to do, and Toyota is going to help them to do that because they know that the Japanese government and the Japanese people want them to do that. So that's kind of a whole different story about Japan. But a lot of these second tier Japanese companies that might have gone away in different circumstances, I think, are not necessarily going to go away so quickly.
Will Honda exist?
Yeah, I believe it will. Honda is they're so beautifully positioned because they're not just a car company. They're a motorcycle company. They're a jet, you know, private jet manufacturer.
They're a snowblower company.
Snowblowers and, you know, electric generators. And you name it. They make
have a lawnmower.
They're arguably the most diversified automaker of all of them.
All right, who else? So we concluded they're all going to be here.
No, they're not. They're not. They're not going to survive. Now, what things could change, though, because, you know, going back to Sergio again, he said, hey, GM and Ford, you know, we're all making 2-liter four-cylinder engines. You know, they're within, you know, microns of each other from the specifications. Why don't we just lump that all together and buy it? You know, I think there would be enormous savings for the three of them. I think collectively you could save, and I'm not exaggerating, up to $20 billion a year if they were to consolidate their powertrain operations. Because the public, by and large, 90% of the car-buying public doesn't care. It's a 2-liter four-cylinder engine. So what? You know, they don't even know where it came from. Mm-hmm. So there could be some consolidation, not of companies per se, but of operations powertrain.
Okay, so I'm trying. That rings bells. So what? Remember the Global Motor? It was Chrysler and Hyundai and
Mitsubishi. Right.
And it seemed like a brilliant idea, you know, that you'd have these three companies. They'd all, you know, they built a plant in Dundee, Michigan, and they'd engineer the same thing. And whatever happened
to
that?
You couldn't bring it to scale, though. I mean, they did it in Dundee, Michigan, and it remained fairly small, right? But that wasn't the plan.
The problem is, and we saw this in the Daimler Chrysler thing too. But going back to your suggestion of this Dundee plant. I think it was Chrysler that designed the engine. Then Hyundai went, well, we don't really want that engine. And Mitsubishi said, but we wanted to make this engine. And they could never agree. Everybody thought it was great. Let's all get together, and we'll all use my idea.
Right.
And the other one, no, let's use my idea. And the other one, no, let's use my idea. And they never got anywhere with it.
Which gets to the point of how could you ever get to the point where you would have these guys all say, yeah, we're going to have the same
The only way to do it is spin it off as a totally separate company. You cannot have these three automakers collaborate together. Now, there is some good collaboration going on. You know, Ford and GM have done some stuff on transmissions. But guess what? You know, Ford does its part and GM does its part, and then they make all kinds of changes, and they've saved some money, but they haven't gotten near the synergy that they thought they would out of it.
So do you think that there ought to be a restructuring of the industry whereby there becomes a, you know, global powertrain manufacturer that is separate from ownership?
That's not going to happen is because these car makers in many ways are reflections of the national aspirations of their country. Volkswagen got itself in horrible trouble with this diesel emission scandal that's cost it $20 billion, perhaps will cost it $30 billion. Nobody thinks Volkswagen's going to go out of business. And nobody from Volkswagen in Germany has gone to jail yet. And why is that? Because this is a major employer in Germany. And Germany is not going to allow Volkswagen to fail. So forget about Volkswagen failing. You look at Hyundai. Hyundai is a reflection of the industrial aspirations of South Korea, just like Toyota is the entity that probably the Japanese people are the most proud of anything that happens. So I don't see any of these entities going away. And you saw what happened to General Motors. General Motors got itself in trouble. U.S. Treasury stepped right up to manage the financing and reorganization of the company. Mm. And that would happen for any of these big automakers. So I don't see it really happening that any of these are going to go away.
Hey, we're down to the end, but we actually got a couple of phone calls that have come in, and we ought to end the show on those. So, Carmen, bring in the first of either one you want to bring in.
Hey, guys. Jonathan out in Old Japan. I think you're off base on the EV thing. If Tesla could deliver 400,000 Model 3s tomorrow, 400,000 would be sold. That means if the product looks good, priced well, accelerates good, performs, handles nicely, people are going to buy it. You know, right now the EV is like the GM Bolt or dumps. You know, too big, ugly, too small, whatever. But the Model 3 is hot. People want it. They can buy it in a minute. Anyway, it's just my 2 cents. Have a good one, guys.
Thanks for that, Jonathan.
Well, I agree to some extent with what he's saying, except I think that the people who want to buy the Tesla Model 3 partly want an electric car and partly they want to buy some identification with the Tesla brand and with Elon Musk. And I don't agree with him about the Bolt. I think it's a terrific car.
Yeah, we'll see what happens. Tesla has shown that if you have a sexy car that really performs, people want it. We also know they're having horrific problems trying to build the damn thing because they skipped all the steps that they should have taken to do it right. Maybe they'll get it straightened out. But look, I think the world will go electric. I don't think it's going to be anytime soon.
I thought it was interesting, Jonathan, when you said if they had 400,000, you know, it just reminded me, you know, if wishes were horses, then beggars would ride. So,
okay, and we have another phone call, Carmen. Let's bring in that one.
Great show, guys. My name's Paul, originally from Michigan, out west now. Hey, could you ask Dr. Data what are the numbers for the Buick Envision for 2018? Envision is the main Buick that's imported from mainland China. I just wanted to know whether it was 10,000, 15,000, 20,000. And just like I think next year is the year that the Ford Focus will, very late next year, will be imported from China too. So just curious, can you give me some numbers, Dr. Data? Let's see how good you are. Just want to see what the numbers are.
All right, so I can give you January sales of this year. They were 2,487 units, which is up 13.7% over January of 2017.
But put that in relation to the rest of the Buick lineup. It's one of their best-selling models now, right?
The Encore, which is built in Korea, I think, isn't it? The Encore, that's the little one?
Yeah, that's the little one.
I think that's built in Korea, that's 4,645. The Buick LaCrosse, which I didn't think existed last week until I was smacked down by my colleague here. That was 3,006 units, so that's more than the...
And that's a sedan.
That's a sedan. And the Buick Enclave, 2,715. So
what'd you say, 2,400
in 87.
For the Envision?
Yeah.
That's okay. That's not that great.
So on an annual, so on a yearly run rate, that's about 25,000, 30,000.
Yeah,
of those coming in.
Right.
Yeah. So it's doing okay. It's outselling the Bolt, which you admire. Which is
I admire it. I don't own one, but
I'm just saying. So I think his point was, you know, this is a car that's coming from China that basically no one knows is coming from China, and you know, how's that doing in terms of sales?
Yeah.
It's being outsold by the Korean vehicle.
Yeah.
I'm not sure people care much about that anymore, do they?
They don't even know.
Yeah, they don't know and they don't care.
No.
So we tell them and they still don't care.
Right. Well, hey, we're going to have to wrap this up. Daron Levine, thanks so much for coming in. Channel 121 on Sirius.
Thanks.
Saturdays at noon.
In the driver's seat.
All right. Gary, good show. This was fun. And I can't wait to drive this Leaf, so... I'll get my chance.
Yes, you will. Maybe you'll drive
it out. They're leaving this one here?
Well, no, they got somebody to take it back over to Nissan.
That's cool.
Yeah. But anyway, we'll be back here again next week, and I want to thank all of you for having tuned in.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems. and by Hyundai. Better drives us.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons, get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.